want to tell you about the linear Eckhart theorem that relates to tensor operators and the Jordan's figure representation for this group. So the idea is this. We all know, I hope, representation theory of SU2. And when you start with this, you can construct a certain class of operators that are known as tensor operators. And also you can rewrite SU2 representation theory using harmonic oscillators in what is known as the Jordan's Wigner representation. This is known for SU2, but in general, the Wigner-Eckhart theorem can be generalized, but only for compact groups. So what I want to show you is that at least for tensor operators, we don't need any conditions on the group being compact. And I'm going to show you the particular case of the 4D Lorentz group, where we can generalize using my results whatever we can do for SU2. So let's start with a quick review of SU2. SU2 is the double cover of SU3, the group of rotations, or the identity component of the group of rotations. It's complexified generators, so I'm considering only complex representations here. So I'm using, instead of SU2, the algebra generators, I'm using the ones of SU2 complexified, just for consistency with the physicist notation. So the three generators, they satisfy these commutation relations. And the unitary reducible representations are those for which J plus dagger is the same as J minus, and J0 is self-adjoint. This is the action on the representation. They're labeled by J, which is an half integer. It can be 0, 1 half, 1, and so on. And each time, each representation is 2J plus 1 dimensional. The basis is labeled by this M that can go from minus J to J in integer steps. And this is the action on this representation. These vectors are eigenvectors of J0. The action of J plus and minus is to go from M to M plus 1 or M minus 1. So they are ladder operators. And J squared is the Casimir of SU2. It can be written in this way in terms of these generators. And it's just going to give us J times J plus 1 when acting on the representation. So first of all, we can rewrite this thing in terms of harmonic oscillators using what is known as the Jordan's Wigner representation. So if we introduce a pair of uncoupled harmonic oscillators, with these commutation relations, and all the other commutation relations are zero, then we can rewrite these generators, J plus, J minus, and J zero, as quadratic polynomials in these harmonic oscillator operators. So in particular, J zero is going to be 1 half of A dagger A minus B dagger B. J plus is A dagger B. J minus is B dagger A. Now, the way you usually come up with this is guesswork. You guess that this is the form of them. You check that their action is consistent. So what happens here is that the sum, if you call Vj the representation that I described here, the one labeled by J, then is a representation of the Eisenberg algebra. Which is generated by this A dagger, B B dagger, and the identity. So this is a well-known result. But I would like to generalize this to the Lorentz group. I'm going to show you later how this is done. But this is closely related to tensor operators. At this stage, I'm going to define them only for SU2, then I'm going to generalize. Tensor operators are a certain class of operators. They are labeled by two indices. And just like vectors in a representation of SU2, they have one of the indices that labels them. They can be an half integer, while the other one goes from minus gamma to gamma. The idea is that these operators, although they are operators acting on representations, they transform under the action of the group as if they were elements of a representation. In terms of the Lie algebra, this means that if you use the adjoint action of the Lie algebra on these operators, this happens. So as you can see, this is exactly analogous to what I wrote here. Just instead of being the generators acting on a vector, it's the adjoint action that's represented by the commutator acting on an operator that is going to then act on a representation. Now, why are these things so important? First of all, many operators are actually described by tensor operators. So the idea is that, for example, the position operator, the momentum operator, are vectors, in the sense that they are operators, that the components of them are going to transform as a vector under the action of the rotation group. This is extremely important because there's something known as the Wigner-Eckardt theorem. Which is one of the most important properties of these operators. The theorem tells us that the matrix elements of a tensor operator. Now, no one is saying that the operator is acting from one representation to the representation itself. It can go from one representation to a different one. So the matrix elements are going to be with also J different. When we consider these matrix elements, these are going to be equal to a number that only depends on J prime, the form of the operator itself, but not the particular component. So there's no reference to mu. And this is known as the reduced matrix element. And then the Clebsch-Hodron coefficient of the decomposition of the representation gamma mu, well, the representation labeled by gamma and the representation labeled by J. The reason why this is so important, and this is used, well, at least it was used in the 70s, a lot in nuclear physics, is that sometimes these tensor operators are big, there's many components, and the representation here is 2J plus one dimensional. With J very big, the representation can be extremely big, but we don't actually need to compute all of the matrix elements. So say if the representation here is 10 dimensional, there's, depending on how many elements we have here, say we go from the same representation to itself, there's 10 elements here, 10 here, there's already 100 possible matrix elements without accounting for the fact that you have two gamma plus one components. But you actually only need to compute one, because all of these are known. We have tables of Clebsch-Hodron coefficients. We don't need to actually work out what this is. And this number is the same for every m, m prime, mu. So instead of calculating 100 matrix elements, you just calculate one of them, you find out what this is, and then you know all of them. Now, this theorem can be generalized to other groups. It doesn't have to be SU2. But usually, you choose the group to be compact, because in order to prove the theorem, the usual proof integrates with the R measure and proves that if you integrate with the R measure on one of the sides, then on the other side you just get a number and you end up with this equality. But if you do that for a non-compact group, when you integrate on the side where you will have a number, you integrate, say, the identity over the R measure, the group is non-compact, you're going to get infinity, and you cannot divide by that anymore. So you cannot actually come up with that. That number that you are dividing for is essentially the reduced matrix element here. So if you integrate in the way, you get something that's of the form infinity equals infinity, and you cannot prove anything. So now I'm going to show you how tensor operators and the Wigner-Eckert theorem can be generalized not only to compact groups, but in general to any group. It doesn't have to be compact or non-compact. The idea is this. This all started, I'm going to tell you a little bit of history of this research. When I gave a talk about this stuff, when I started working on it, actually to physicists, and they asked me, is there a way to rewrite tensor operators in a basis-independent way? Why do we have components? And actually, I didn't know how to answer that. It would make sense that the tensor operator can be written in a basis-independent way. Now I know how to do that. So I'm going to define a new notion of tensor operators. And for reasons that are going to be clear shortly, I'm going to call it a strong tensor operator. So a strong tensor operator is going to be an operator that goes from here to here. Now, given a group G, V and V prime are G modules, which is a fancy name for representations. And since the group is a Lie group, I'm working with Lie groups, we're going to work with topological representations. V0 is a finite dimensional G module. I work with finite dimensional G modules here for just convenience. It's much easier to work with, and I don't see any physical applications of working with something not finite there. And the only requirement here is that T is an intertwiner. By which I mean it's an isomorphism. Well, actually, it doesn't have to be an isomorphism, it's just a morphism between this representation and this representation. Explicitly, this means that T commutes with the action of the group. Now, this definition is essentially the same as this, because then you can introduce the coordinate description, you can get the components of this tensor, but just defining this. If you have a basis in the representation V0, which is finite dimensional, then you just define the components in this way. It's going to be the map that goes from a vector V in this representation, and we're going to assign to it this. So the components are going to be given by the choice of the basis in our representation. So in particular, if we do this for SU2, the components are of this form because we chose this particular basis, the one given by eigenvectors of J0. Now, these were the strong tensor operators, but I'm actually going to need a weaker definition. This is too strong for my tastes, and that's because we need to work with topological representations. I want to work with non-compact groups, which means the representations, if they're unitary, are going to be infinite dimensional. And if you consider topological infinite dimensional representations, then we have to worry about the topology. We have to worry about whether something is reducible or not. Not only the only proper subspaces to be the empty one and the group and the vector space itself, it has to also be a closed proper subspace. I don't want to worry about that. I want to do everything like I do with SU2. I want to work at the Lie algebra level instead of working at the group level. In order to do this, I'm going to use the mathematical tool of GK algebras, GK modules, sorry. So instead of working with G modules, I work with GK modules. Now, I don't know if you know what these are, but I want to give you a brief description. They are essentially an extension of a G module, that would be just a representation. Here, G is the Lie algebra associated to the group. I hope that's clear. That's sort of a fracture font. So in general, what would we do? If a representation, we define the action of the Lie algebra in this way. If X is an element of the Lie algebra, X acting on the vector would be the derivative with respect to some parameter at t equals 0 of this. But that works for finite dimensional representations. If you're working for infinite dimensional representations, there's absolutely no reason to expect this thing here to still be in the federal representation space. So in order to do that, we had to work with GK modules. These are essentially representations of the Lie algebra and representations of K, which is the maximal compact subgroup of G. And of course, there's going to be some appropriate conditions to make sure they cohabitate peacefully. Now, this is the mathematical background that we need. I'm not going to go too much into details. But the reason why these things are very useful is this. I have a small list of useful properties of these things. First of all, if you have a G module, let's call it H, we may assume that it's on a Hilbert space. And from now on, when I say G module, I mean topological G module. Then a certain subspace of it, which is defined in this way, this is essentially, this is known as the subspace of K finite vectors. It means that when we act, we consider all the possible actions of the maximal compact subgroup on a vector, then the span of that result is going to be finite dimensional. Now, this thing here can be shown to be a GK module. So we call it the underlying GK module to the representation. So to any G module, we can associate an underlying GK module. So there's always one of them for every representation. And why is it useful to work with this instead? Well, remember I told you, if you want to find out if a representation is irreducible, you have to worry about the topology. You don't have to do that with the GK modules, because there's no topology here. Even when you talk about K module here, you are forgetting about the topology of K. It's a K module just as a normal module. There's no topology there. So what happens here is that an admissible, and I'm going to tell you what admissible means in a moment, G module H is irreducible if and only if HK is. And when HK is irreducible, that's not topology. It just means it doesn't have any other proper subspaces other than the empty thing is the space in itself. Now, admissible representations are those that satisfy some conditions. First of all, let's write it here. A GK module V is admissible but if every K module appears finitely many times in B. Now, this is the mathematical requirement, but basically what we're doing is restricting our representations to be nice. Now, what do I mean by nice? There's nice representation in the sense that the closest ones to unitary reducible representations. And that's because a G module H is admissible if and only if the underlying GK module is. And all of the unitary reducible representations are admissible. So if you only want to work with those, then we can just work with the admissible ones. It's the same. The admissible ones are bigger, but they are the ones that are not unitary, but they can be not unitary, but they are nice enough so that many results hold for them. So for example, when you're studying for a non-compact group, all the possible unitary representations, you don't have to worry about the topology. If you find the representation and you want to make sure it's reducible, you can check the GK module and check that that's reducible without worrying about topologies. It's just algebraic. And finally, well, I can just tell you because I don't want to write it down there. Another thing you can do is to make sure the two unitary representations are equivalent, unitarily equivalent. You don't have to check it for the representation themselves. You can check it for the underlying modules. So that's the mathematical reason why you need them. The reason why I use them is that I want to do everything in an algebraic way. To do that and do it properly, you have to use GK modules. As a matter of fact, when I studied these things, I didn't use them. I realized later that I needed them. When I was working with the 4D learners group, I was following Harish Chandra's paper that he wrote when he was still a physicist. That's actually how this whole field started. He did this paper. He wanted to work algebraically. He just used a G module structure. He realized later on that it was not consistent. It was not mathematically rigorous. He went to Dirac. He told him, I think there's a mistake in the paper. And Dirac told him, I don't care. I just want the physics. I don't care about the math. So that's partially why he decided to switch to math. And he then created this notion of GK modules. So I sort of followed the same path. I was working with just the naive idea of algebraic structures. But you had to formalize it with GK modules if you wanted to work. So now I can tell you, finally, what the weak definition of tensor operator is. Well, it's essentially the same thing. A weak tensor operator, or just tensor operator for the following, is going to be a map that goes from V0 times V to V prime, but now these are all GK modules instead of G modules. This one is still finite dimensional. The other one can be finite dimensional, infinite dimensional. It's not important. But this time is going to be a morphism in the GK modules class, which means it's going to be satisfying this. You're going to commute with the action of all the Lie algebra elements, but also with the action of the elements of the maximal compact subgroup. So I'm going to work with these because then I don't have to worry about topology. I can just work algebraically with these things. If you do this in coordinates, you're going to get the same thing I got for SU2. You're going to get commutators between the operators and the Lie algebra elements. That's what I want. Because it's easy to do this, when you're actually working on a concrete example, it's easy to find operators in this way, but it's difficult to do them at the group level. At the group level, you will just have something that tells you the g ti g to the minus 1 equals something. That's the component definition of being an intertwiner. But this is difficult to check. The other one is much easier to check. And of course, this definition of strong and weak makes sense because a strong operator, since every G module has an underlying GK module, is going to also be a weak tensor operator among the underlying GK modules. So I'm going to only work with these ones. And the Wigner-Eckert theorem works for these, which means it's also going to work for the strong ones. So I'm only worrying about these ones. So now the Wigner-Eckert theorem, unfortunately for Wigner and Eckert, is not a theorem anymore. When you do this, the Wigner-Eckert theorem is a corollary to a lemma because it's essentially the same as Schur's lemma. Because at this point, the thing I told you at the beginning makes sense. You have an operator that goes between these and these. We know for Schur's lemma that the morphism between this GK module and this GK module exists if and only if V prime appears in the decomposition of a zero times V. So the same thing that we did before is going to happen. So T can be different than zero if and only if V prime appears in here. And the same thing that happens before happens. I'm not going to write it out because I would have to introduce new notations, which are just going to take space on the board. But the idea is the same. These things are going to, the tensor operators are going to split as projections on the possible decompositions in here. And the coefficients are going to be just the type Schrodinger coefficients. So there was absolutely no need to use integration and the R measure, which means you don't need the group to be non-compact. I didn't talk about compactness anywhere in here. The only thing I required is that this is finite dimensional. If it's not finite dimensional, it's like having something with infinitely many components. I don't really see physical applications for that, and that's why I'm not using it, but it can be done in theory. I didn't try. So now it seems everything is working fine, but there's still a problem. And the problem is, what is the decomposition? In general, we don't know this. If you're working with compact groups, then it's fine. We know that this thing is always going to be decomposable. We may not know exactly the decomposition, but we know it's decomposable. It's already a start. And in many cases, we know how to decompose it. If the group is non-compact, not only we don't know the decomposition, so that's problem one. In general, we don't know. But the second problem, which is bigger, is that there's no guarantee that there is a decomposition. It can easily not exist. So the problem here is that, sure, I proved the theorem. Well, I proved that there is a lemma to a corollary, or corollary to a lemma. But I actually need to know the Clebsch-Schrodinger coefficients in order to use this theorem. So for SU2, we know them. And in general, it's very difficult. So I chose easy examples. I'm not going to tell you about that now, but the first thing I did was the 3D Lorentz group, because it's much closer to SU2. That was easier to do. So I was able to find the Clebsch-Schrodinger decomposition in that case, between the product of a finite dimensional representation and an infinite dimensional one. And now I'm going to show you what happens in the case of the 4D Lorentz group. That's more interesting, and that's the one that's more difficult to do. I did the other one first because some results were already known for the one, but not at all for the 4D case.
Can you interrupt the word whispered
What do you mean by extensions?
I could be misremembering, but I thought that, do you guys remember that like, it's not, two-dimensional did not completely risk of origin, right?
Yeah.
So having a map is not the same as being a sub.
Well, they have to be admissible. I'm not saying it out loud, but all of this stuff is done for admissible representations.
I thought. Even with those conditions, I'm not sure that's true. You have maps between representations where B prime is not a sub representation. B not.
Well, I'm just using Schur's lemma. So
Schur's lemma doesn't hold for GK modules?
It does. There's a version of the Schur's lemma for GK modules. So I took it from Balak's book, so if you want to ask him, I trusted him. There is a version of the Schur's lemma that works for GK modules.
So in your notation, I assume the 0B and B prime are what, they're all irreducible?
Yes, they're, well, these don't need to be reducible. The theorem to work, they have to be reducible. So yes, in general, the tensor operators doesn't need any of these to be reducible. You call it irreducible if zero is irreducible. The Wittinger-Eckardt theorem only works when all these representations are irreducible. So yes, I forgot to tell you that. In the case in which all of them are reducible, then the Schur's lemma does hold for GK modules, and they have to be admissible.
Well,
I'm pretty sure it does work. But anyway, we can talk about it later. So, we don't need this anymore. So now, without too many details, I want to show you what happens when you try to do this for the full Lorentz group. Instead of working with the 4D Lorentz group itself, I'm going to work with this double cover, just as I did for SU2. So I'm going to work with spin 3-1. That's a double cover of this group. I'm going to choose the identity component of the Lorentz group. So in physicist notation, it will be the proper orthochronous Lorentz group. Now the generators are going to be, that's the generators of the SU2 subgroup. And then we have the boost generators, which are denoted by K. And these are the computation relations. It's not really important, but I just wrote them down so we know what we're working with. The Casimirs are 2 in this case. So there's this Casimir and this one. Now I'm going to give you the representation theory. And this is going to be for all possible admissible irreducible representations. They're going to be both infinite dimensional and finite dimensional. And they are given in terms of GK modules. So I can give you everything in terms of the algebraic action on these vector spaces. So I'm not actually going to write down all the things because they're not really useful for us. What's important is that the representations are labeled by 2 numbers. So here, lambda is an half integer, it can be also negative. And rho is a complex number in general. Since I'm assuming representations to also be non-unitary, I take it to be complex in general. And these are related to the values of the Casimirs. So on this representation, C1 acts like this, and C2 acts like this. And what happens here is this representation can be written as a direct sum of SU2 representations. So these are the K modules that appear in it. And you can see that they only appear once. So this is admissible because there's no repetition. I mean, they appear finitely many times. In particular, they appear once. And J is going to start from the absolute value of lambda, and it's going to go to some J max that can be infinity or some number for finite dimensional representations. And notice that when I write this direct sum here, since we're working with modules, vector spaces that are not, don't have a topology, what I'm going to do this is consider it just algebraic direct sums. So whenever I write something in here, it's just going to be a finitely many elements in each, whenever we write a vector. We cannot take one vector to each one of these spaces because otherwise it doesn't make sense algebraically. So this is going to be a GK module. The K module structure is on this each one of these things. So this means that J, despite it as a vector, is going to go from each one of these spaces to itself. And that's because it commutes with J squared, which is the Casimir for SU2. While the K vectors are going to go within different values of J. So they go from here to this one. So it can be J minus 1, J, and J plus 1. And as a matter of fact, this comes out to be because K is a vector operator, let's say a particular kind of tensor operator for SU2. If you check the computational relations, they are right here. If you rewrite it in the appropriate basis, this tells us that K is a tensor operator for SU2. And the Wigner-Eckert theorem tells us that's the only way you can have it. The only decomposition of this transforms like a representation with spin 1. So the only thing you can have is stay with the same J, go to J plus 1 or J minus 1. Nothing else appears in the decomposition, so all the other cases don't appear here. And you can actually use the Wigner-Eckert theorem to find the matrix elements of all the K operators. And last thing I have to tell you is, for finite dimensional representations, there's an easy way to describe them. And they're the ones that are most widely known. Usually when you ask about representations of the Lorentz group, people assume that you mean the finite dimensional ones. It's very difficult to find results about the infinite dimensional ones. So what you do here is use the fact that at the Lie algebra level, if you complexify everything, this is the same as just taking two copies of SU2, complexified. So if you do this, you can rewrite the generators in a new form. Instead of using J and K, you introduce new generators. If I use these new generators M, and A can be plus or minus 1, these happen to be the generators of this SU2 and of this SU2 when you change the A. They satisfy the usual SU2 computation relations. And when the representation is finite dimensional, it also so happens that if you define M plus and minus the same way as we will do usually, then this is the same as M minus A, and then A0 is self-adjoint, which means the representations that we're using for SU2 are actually the usual SU2 representations, the one I gave you at the beginning. So every representation, every finite dimensional representation of the 4D Lorentz group can be written in this way. You're essentially taking the product of two representations of SU2. So usually we denote them in this way. We denote this representation by just the pair J1, J2. And both labels can be alpha integers. So for example, 0, 0 will be the scalar representation. And then you can have 1 half, 0, and 0, 1 half. These are the left and right value representation. So they are basically the left and right spinors. Or you could have the direct sum of these two, which is, of course, not irreducible anymore. And this is the Dirac spinner. So these are related to the same ones we wrote down before. And I'm going to write these in a different way because something here happens. You can always write any generic one as the product of two of them. So you could write these times this. So instead of working with the most general one, I'm going to work with these and these. They are just left representations or right representations. So I'm going to use the notation f, a, j. F is for finite. A is going to tell me if it's left or right. And j tells me the spin. So this is going to be either j, 0, if a is minus 1, or 0, j, if a is plus 1. So this was all the notation we needed. Now what we want to do, in order to use the big Eckart theorem, we need the decomposition of finite dimensional representation times another one. So I want to know what this is. And I'm going to call it gamma just so I distinguish from the other letters. I want to know what happens here. So I'm going to skip all the details because they're very long and boring. I'm going to tell you at the end where you can find all these notions if you don't trust me or if you want to check it yourself. But there's a couple of interesting things here. And this all happens because you're working with a non-compact group. So first of all, I'm assuming that this is infinite dimensional. If it's finite dimensional, we already know the answer because it's just SU2 representation theory. If this is infinite dimensional, this representation may be unitary or not, but this is never unitary unless it's a trivial representation, in which case the whole question is trivial. So let's assume that's not a trivial representation and the other one is infinite dimensional. Then the Casimirs on this representation are neither self-adjoint and not even normal. We cannot use the spectral theorem to try to decompose this. And that's why there's no guarantee that this thing actually works. And also, the fact that they're not normal operators means that even if you have a decomposition, it doesn't have to be a unitary decomposition. There's no guarantee that the direct sum we get is actually an orthonormal direct sum. In fact, it's not going to be. So what happens here is there is a result, but there is a condition on lambda rho. It doesn't always work. This has to happen. This number must not be in here. So as long as it's not integer, then we're fine. But if it's integer and it's also between minus 2 gamma and 2 gamma excluded, then there is no decomposition. This thing is not decomposable. So we have to assume this happens, and then we're going to have a direct sum. I'm going to denote it with this new symbol because it's not an orthogonal direct sum. It's going to be a direct sum, but if we give these two spaces an Hilbert space structure, actually we can't because they're not topological spaces. We can just give it an inner product structure. Then these are not going to preserve it. The spaces are going to be independent, just as vector spaces, but they're not going to be orthogonal. So now this happens here. We get this decomposition, lambda plus nu. And whether we add or subtract for rho depends from A. So this is the result. It took me a long time to find this. It's actually very simple when you write it down, but proving it is very difficult because this space is infinite dimensional here. So you cannot easily find the decomposition. The way I did it is by recursion. You start with the simplest case, which is f 1 half a. You can actually solve the 1 easily by hand. And then you prove everything else by constructing bigger ones from products of these and another one. So it takes a while to do that, but you can just by induction prove this thing. Now, why is this important? I mean, the result itself is useful and nice. You can, of course, calculate the Clebsch-Rodin coefficients here. But the reason why I need it is to go back to what I wanted to tell you, the Jordan-Zwinger representation. There is a Jordan-Zwinger representation for the 4D Lorentz group. But that's because we assume, and I hope I didn't cancel it yet, that this happens. When we have finite dimensional representations, we have a Zwinger-Jordan representation here, we have another one here, and so we know that we can rewrite these M operators in terms, or this time four harmonic oscillators, two for the left SU2 representation, two for the right one. But that's only for finite dimensional representations. So what if we want to extend it to unitary representations? There was no notion of the Jordan-Zwinger in that case. So what we do instead is, first of all, realize that the Jordan-Zwinger representation is nothing else than using, instead of harmonic oscillators, tensor operators to describe these vectors, or the generators. So the first thing we do, you can do this with SU2 already. You figure out, for SU2, this happens. Those A and the dagger, B and B dagger, are actually components of tensor operators. If you call them T and T tilde, they're going to be minus B A and A dagger B dagger. You can put them as components. So this would be T minus 1 half. This is T plus 1 half, and so on. If you check the commutation relations with the J0, J plus minus generators, then you find out that these are actually spinor operators. I mean, tensor operators that transform like the 1 half representation. So you could do that. And in fact, that's the way to prove, if you don't want to guess it, that the Jordan-Zwinger representation exists. So I'm going to show it to you in this case. So we're going to work with those M operators that I defined here. These are the ones I want to show that can be written in terms of harmonic oscillators, or something that looks like them very much. So what we do is this. We have to come up with two harmonic oscillators. Well, sorry, two tensor operators, and actually two pair representation. So there's going to be A, can be minus or plus 1. It's going to tell us if it's left or right. And also a T tilde. And this is a 1 half representation. Assuming this condition is satisfied, where gamma is 1 half, then you can see from here that there's only two representation. One that goes from to lambda minus 1 half, rho plus a over 2. The other one is going to go to, sorry, it was minus and minus, and then the other one goes to plus 1/2 plus a over 2. So there's only two things that can happen. I'm going to choose one of them to go plus and the other one to go minus. So this goes from lambda rho to lambda minus 1/2 rho minus a over 2. This one does the other thing. And I know that these operators can exist because the Wigner theorem tells me that there exist non-zero tensor operators. The only thing I have to do is choose the reduced matrix element, because these things are fully specified up to the reduced matrix element. When you take the, so this one will be L lambda minus 1/2 rho minus a over 2. If you take the matrix element of this, one in, with one of the components, then what happens here is that this is going to be proportional to the reduced matrix element. I'm going to call it in this way. And then there's just the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, which I'm not going to write down. But the point is that this one is known. I have a nice table in the paper. And this is the only thing that's left to fix. Once I decided that we go only to minus or only to plus, same thing happens for the tilde. So what I do is just put there an ansatz. I decide that I can rewrite this operator We don't need this anymore. The M operators, instead of writing them as they are, you can make them into tensor operators. So you're going to work with this instead. You want to work with these and these ones. They are essentially the same thing. I just rescale them and multiply them by plus or minus 1. The reason why I want to work with this is that this thing, this VA, is a tensor operator. It transforms as this. So it's something that goes from F1A times V lambda rho. And it actually stays inside, because these are just the generators I'm going to act on the same vector space. And so the idea is this. I didn't tell you this, but another thing you can do with tensor operators, just as representations, you can merge them together, you multiply them, and they're going to have a decomposition. So you can multiply 2 1/2 representations, and you can get 0 or 1 out of them. So we know that this transforms as a vector representation, the one with spin 1. I'm going to assume that it can be written as the product of a 1/2 and 1/2 representation. So this V mu A, where mu can be minus 1, 0, or 1, and this is my ansatz, I assume that can be written in this way. I'm going to have here the Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. These ones are SU2 Clebsch-Gordan coefficients. We know them very well. So these are just the coefficients of the decomposition of 1/2 times 1/2, the one that gives you 1 out. And you multiply by this, t and t tilde, in 1, u2. This is my answer. I assume that this is true. And I want to use this in order to fix TA and T tilde A. So what do? I take the matrix elements on both sides. I know the matrix elements of this, because these are the generators. I know how they act on vectors. I know the matrix elements of this side, because I know the Wigner-Neckar theorem. They are going to be dependent on these functions t and t tilde, but other than that, I know everything. So I do that. When I equate both sides, I find that the answer is indeed satisfied if I choose ta lambda rho equals t tilde a lambda rho and equals lambda plus a rho under the square root. If you do this, you can actually construct this. And this is what we're going to call Jordan's Wigner representation. If you do the same thing for SU2, same trick, you assume the set tensor operator, you write it in this way, you check the matrix elements on both sides, the ones you're going to find eventually come out to be the harmonic oscillators. And in fact, once you fix them, if you check the matrix elements and the commutation between all these operators, what you're going to get is this. You get t plus a this is going to be the same as this one. Equals the identity. Essentially, like the harmonic oscillators. And in fact, they still generate the Heisenberg algebra. The only difference is that there's absolutely no guarantee that these things are one the adjoint of the other. In fact, they are not. It's not true. Let's say this is related with some coefficient in front of it to this. This does not happen. If this happened, there would be harmonic oscillators. They are not harmonic oscillators. They are something very similar. They still generate some, at least some complex version of the Heisenberg algebra. I don't know which kind of representation it is to this day. I'm still trying to figure it out. But I know the way they act, so I don't actually need to know the representation theory. I know that they make sense because I actually know their explicit action on the vectors. So if you do the same thing for SU2 or for the finite dimensional representations, you're going to find the same thing, but then they are indeed related by taking the adjoint of one of them. So this is almost all I wanted to tell you. The only thing that's left is, why is this important, other than just the mathematical beauty of it? Well, there are reasons why you would want to use this. Now, I showed you what happens for the Fourier Lorentz case, because it's more interesting, as it's quite more difficult. But you can do the same thing for the 3D case. In the 3D case, you essentially have the same generators as this one, because the complexification of the Lie algebra is still the same. The only thing that changes is the conditions that give you unitary representations. This time it will be this equals minus j minus. There's this minus coming up that changes which real form of SL2C you're taking. If you take the plus here, then you're taking SU2. If you have the minus, you're taking either SU11 or SL2R. Now, when you do that, and that's the reason why I started doing all these things, is that you can get the Jordan's Wigner representation for the 3D Lorentz group. And when I started doing these things, I was trying to apply these things to quantum gravity. Now, in quantum gravity, people like to work with SU2 very much, mostly because it's compact and you can do very nice things with it. But what I tried to do, and this was the way I started working with these things, my supervisor, when I was studying my PhD, gave me this exercise. He said, let's not take SU2. Let's consider 3D quantum gravity, but on a Lorentzian spacetime. So instead of using SU2, you end up using the 3D Lorentz group as your gauge group. So he assumed that these things, the Wigner-Neckar theorem tensor operators, would be exactly the same, would be terribly easy to do. So I started doing this, and after 2 years, I figured out that this whole thing happens. Once you do that, and you find the Jordan's Wigner representation, you can apply something that's known as the spinner formalism. Which is essentially using the Jordan spin representation in quantum gravity, just a fancy way to say it, also to this case. And not only you can construct those t and t tilde, and you can use them to construct the j operators, you can construct a whole class of operators out of those. So the same way you take together two one-half operators to get a vector operator, you can build scalar operators out of that. You can do it in many ways. You can contract t with t, t with t tilde, t tilde with t tilde. There are basically three different ways to construct scalar operators. And they are very nice and useful in quantum gravity because you want your operators to be gauge invariant. So you want exactly the scalar operators of all of them. That's actually the reason why I neglected v0 to be infinite dimensional, both for the 3D and 4D Lorentz group. If V0 was infinite dimensional, there's no way to contract two infinite dimensionals to get a finite dimensional one. I wanted scalar operators. So I completely skipped over that. So this is the work I did with my supervisor, Florian Girelli, and it's ended up in my thesis. And I didn't find the nice applications in the 4D case yet, but I know that people tried to do the spinner formalism in 4D using spin form. They tried to do the spinner formalism, and they only did it at the classical level. They could not do the quantum version. And the reason why is that they didn't know that you can use the Jordan Zwinger representation at the quantum level. They did it classically. That's essentially doing the finite dimensional one. When you try to quantize it, it doesn't make sense. So these are some of the possible applications. I'm hoping that soon I can actually find an application of this. But I wanted to tell you about the mathematical part, which I never get to talk about. So thank you very much for listening. That's all I had. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer.
Yes. Do you know what the adjoints of these operators are? Can you express them at all in terms of these things?
Yes, the problem is these matrix elements, okay, what happens is they're almost adjoints too. Not only they satisfy the commutation relations, they are transpose of each other. And of course there's a problem with transpose because it's a basis dependent definition in this case. But the matrix elements are basically this. If you take the ones of the t, they're up to a plus or minus sign. They're the same as the ones of the t tilde. But they're not always real or always imaginary when you're dealing with non-compact groups and infinite dimensional representations. So it doesn't happen that you can always say that's the transpose. But you can still relate them. They're going to be the transpose of each other.
Are there further questions? Thank you so much.